Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, July 24th, 2014. The IGAD-led peace talks are set to resume at the end of the month.
The government strongly believes that peace will not come through the muzzle of the gun, but will come through peace on the table. So, despite the violations of the rebels, this will not change the position of the government.
And a new UNMISS boss is heading to Juba.
She was the UN envoy in Liberia, and she was there for 4 years, from 2008 to 2012. And I think you can get an idea of how she might perform in South Sudan from how she performed in Liberia.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. IGAD announced yesterday that peace talks for South Sudan will resume next week. The talks were put on hold last month when opposition negotiators did not show up for the opening session. In a statement released in Addis Ababa, IGAD, which has been leading the effort to bring peace to South Sudan, said that the next round of talks will run from July 30th until August 10th. The focus of the negotiations will be to come up with a binding cessation of hostilities agreement and to work out the details of the transitional government of national unity. President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar agreed at the beginning of June to set up a transitional government within 30 days. That means the deadline for doing so will fall during the next round of talks. No work has been done so far on setting up that interim government. A spokesman for Mr. Kiir's government in Juba says he welcomes the announcement by IGAD that the talks will resume and stresses that peace can only come through dialogue. Minister of Information Michael McQuay says the government feels that the IGAD-led talks are the only way to end the seven-month crisis in South Sudan.
So the government strongly believes that peace will not come through the muzzle of the gun, but will come through peace on the table. So, despite the violations of the rebels, this will not change the position of the government. We'll continue to negotiate with the rebels with the objective of achieving a permanent peace to our people.
South Sudan has been mired in conflict since December when a political dispute within the country's ruling party, the SPLM, turned violent. Peace efforts led by IGAD for 6 months now have, as we said, produced a cessation of hostilities agreement, but it was violated almost from the day it was signed in January. Last month, the IGAD-mediated talks stalled when opposition negotiators boycotted the opening session. A spokesman for the opposition says they did not show up for the talks because a request that the negotiation should include representatives of people displaced by the conflict and groups that have fled Juba fell on deaf ears. McQuay says his team is optimistic a deal will be reached with the rebels when the talks resume. He says if the rebels insist the talks should only be between the government and opposition, the government will still be willing to go ahead with those negotiations.
As for the government, we are in search of peace. And in the course of our search for peace, we are ready to negotiate with anybody, anywhere, anytime.
That report was written and prepared by Waki Simon Wudu in Juba. Opposition negotiators say they're willing to return to the talks with the government. The leader of the SPLM in opposition, Riek Machar, says he received assurances from IGAD the next round of talks will include South Sudanese civil society, political, and faith-based groups who fled Juba after the fighting broke out in December. Machar says the opposition supports IGAD's decision to restart the peace talks.
They have accepted they will start the process of selection, and the peace talks will resume.
These stakeholders that are going to be part of the peace talks, are these the people who ran from Juba and they are in Nairobi, in Kampala, in Khartoum, and in Addis?
That is right. Those who flee the country because of fear of their lives to the neighboring countries, Uganda, Ethiopia, Nairobi, and Khartoum. And these involve political parties, civil society organizations, faith-based groups. These are the ones that will be given a chance to be selected and be involved in the peace process.
And there was also an issue about the numbers. Around 250 people came from Juba. Now, these groups that are going to be inclusive this time around, Is there any figure that we can talk about? How many people are we talking about here?
Well, I can't tell you exactly, but it will be, the issue is being addressed adequately.
That's rebel leader Riek Machar speaking from the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa to my colleague John Tanza at VOA's Nairobi studio. Members of an African Union commission investigating human rights abuses committed during South Sudan's conflict are calling on the warring sides to do more to end the war and restore peace. The team, led by former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo, wound up a five-day visit to South Sudan today. Philip Thon Oleu has this report from Juba.
Mr. Obasanjo says the international community is doing what it can to help, but South Sudanese themselves must take the lead in resolving the conflict in their country. In particular, Obasanjo says leaders on both sides in the conflict have to take a bigger role to end the conflict.
The EU can only help. The South Sudanese are the architects of their own fortune, or if you like, to a large extent, their own misfortune. Let's be honest with ourselves. The countries in Africa must be the ones that will take the responsibility for preventing conflict, destruction, violence in their own country.
Obasanjo says the AU Commission of Inquiry in South Sudan will leave no stone unturned as it proves right abuses and violations of international humanitarian law during the seven-month conflict in South Sudan. He says there must be accountability for all atrocities committed since the fighting started, including in Juba, where there are allegations of targeted ethnic killings at the beginning of the conflict.
After Juba massacre, you can also talk of Bo massacre. You can also talk of Bentiu massacre. You can talk of Malakal massacre. All these impunities must be stopped.
Commission members say they have gathered what they call useful information to enable them to determine what crimes were committed and by whom. Vineta Diop, who in addition to serving on the commission, is the AU's special envoy for women, peace and security, says the team met top government officials, including President Salva Kiir, during their five-day visit to South Sudan.
The commander of the Presidential Guard invited the commission on a tour of the unit's cantonment, which an exercise which threw more light into the ongoing narrative of the current situation in the country. Other key individual that was met was the Director General of National Intelligence and Security, who also gave useful explanation as to the event that unfolded and are still unfolding in the country.
The AU team also met with officials from the UN and IGAD, the regional bloc mediating peace talks for South Sudan, and with some of the hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese who have been displaced by the conflict, Diop says. Commission members also met with officials deployed by IGAD to monitor any ceasefire violations on the ground and held talks with opposition leader Riek Machar and former political detainees in Addis Ababa prior to their visit to South Sudan, Diop says. This is the third time the officials have visited South Sudan since the commission was formed in March. During earlier trips, the team met with internally displaced persons sheltering in UN bases in Juba, Bor, Bentiu and Malakal. Diop pledged that the AU commission will go extra mile to restore lasting peace and security in South Sudan. They have already visited the three states hardest hit by the fighting, Jonglei, Unity, and Upper Nile. The next step, Diop says, will be other states.
The Commission of Inquiry on South Sudan will extend the scope of the current activities to the other states of the Republic that were not affected by current conflict in order to obtain firsthand their impression of the situation in the country and what, in their opinion, may be the way forward for the nation.
Mr. Obasanjo says the team will put together a report that will be submitted to the AU Peace and Security Council in around 3 months. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleu in Juba.
The UN mission in South Sudan has a new chief. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon yesterday named Ellen Margrethe Loy of Denmark to head the mission. Loy succeeds Hilde Johnson of Norway, who completed her three-year assignment in South Sudan on July 7th. VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir says the UN strongly believes Loy brings a wealth of experience in peacekeeping and international affairs to the job, given her previous postings.
Ellen Marguerite Loy is really a seasoned Danish diplomat. She had posts in the Danish Foreign Ministry as an ambassador to Israel, the permanent representative here at the United Nations. But really significantly, she was the UN envoy in Liberia, and she was there for 4 years, from 2008 to 2012. And I think you can get an idea of how she might perform in South Sudan from how she performed in Liberia. And she stepped into that country at a very important time. After the Civil War, they were rebuilding. The UN had about 15,000 peacekeepers there at the time. Now they only have 6,000. So the country has really improved a lot. Stability has returned. There's more capacity in the state institutions and such. So I think she's a really good administrator, and she will be a positive force for the mission in South Sudan.
It sounds like she's a really good pick for this, but South Sudan obviously is a tough assignment. Do you think that, and do others think, that she is up to the job?
Well, I don't think the Secretary General would have appointed her to such an important mission at an important, sensitive time if he didn't think she was up to it. Hildy Johnson, who just left the mission, she was a bit controversial, especially towards the end of her tenure. She had problems with the government, with President Kiir and such. Ms. Loy is a really tough woman. She's 66 years old. She's mature. She's seasoned. She's strong. She's known to really be kind of a strong person. Good luck to Salva Kiir if he wants to give her a hard time, and Riek Machar, too, for that matter. You know, she's a strong person and leader. Part of the UN mission, they helped oversee elections in Liberia in 2011. They helped, really build capacity and help the country transition. These are things that really South Sudan needs, too. So she has the experience that she can bring to this from Liberia, and I think that will be good for South Sudan. And also, don't forget, Liberia was coming out of a big civil war. There were underlying issues among communities and such. Similar problems we're seeing in South Sudan today.
Exactly. Do you think she'll be instrumental in breaking the logjam at the peace talks in Addis Ababa, and more importantly, just ending the fighting that seems to continue, at least in parts of South Sudan?
Well, I don't know if she'll be instrumental. So much of it is up to the players on the ground. You know, they need to want it. But if anyone can do it, she probably can. You know, she's going to be a tough negotiator. She's not going to take any baloney from them. And she's going to be, really keep her eye on the prize, which is to see peace and stability in South Sudan and see that country prosper and move forward. And I think that she's the kind of person who will really take her mission seriously and work hard to achieve it.
VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with me from UN headquarters in New York earlier today about the new UNMISS chief, Ellen Marguerite Loy. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Malakal, Upper Nile University, relocates to Juba. Stay tuned.
For all the latest in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to Voice of America's South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 16:30 to 1700 UTC. You can email us at southsudan@voanews.com. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan. Or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how can you improve tourism in your country?
First and foremost, for any tourism to take place, we have to work on our security first, and then the infrastructure such as roads. That's the only way to improve tourism, to begin with.
I don't think we've done our homework correct, as in marketing our resources very well. That's where we have failed as a country. We failed to market our natural resources. Marketing is the key word when it comes to tourism.
The government should find a way of making it cheaper for the locals, so that at the end of the day, I am also able to market it outside.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. A Sudanese woman convicted of renouncing Islam and sentenced to death made a surprise early morning escape from Sudan and met this morning with the Pope at the Vatican. Miriam Yahya Ibrahim Ishak spent a half an hour with Pope Francis in his residence. The Pope told reporters he wanted to show support for Ibrahim's devotion to her religious faith. The world was caught by surprise today when Ibrahim, her husband, and two children stepped off an Italian plane in Rome. She and her family had sought refuge from Sudanese authorities at the U.S. Embassy in Khartoum on June 26th. Officials from the U.S. and Italy have not yet explained her overnight escape. A Sudanese official told Reuters they had approved of her departure in advance, but her lawyer in Khartoum said today he had not been informed of the family's escape. Some residents of Western Bahar al-Ghazal are calling for the national capital to be relocated from Juba to their state capital, Wau. State Governor Zakaria Hassan Rizik said earlier this month, when President Kiir visited Western Bahar al-Ghazal, that unlike Juba, Wau has enough land to house public institutions and the potential to produce electricity on a large scale. It has also remained peaceful during the conflict in the country. Michael Atit reports from Wau.
Hundreds of primary and secondary school pupils joined a peaceful demonstration in Wau yesterday to show their support for moving South Sudan's capital from Juba to the capital of Western Bahar al-Ghazal State. Mary Emilio Bafuka, the head of a local NGO called Women of South Sudan, says the people of Wau are generous and welcoming and are ready to host the national capital.
Wau is an old town and we are ready to receive any state institutions. We have the spirit of unity and peace among our people. That is why we have come out to support Wau as the capital city of South Sudan.
Bafuka says she believes relocating the capital to Wau will bring development to the area. Western Bahar al-Ghazal Information Minister Derek Uya Alfred says relocating the national capital to Wau will help to create jobs in the region and boost the local economy. He also says there is a plenty of room in Western Bahar al-Ghazal for everyone who would come to the region if the capital were moved there. He says the state government has a master plan to develop Wau into a wealthy national capital.
We have enough land and there are no people living on it. If you go to Raja County and other places, there is a lot of land. This land might belong to some people, but it could be rented out and then everyone will be better off.
35-year-old Antoinette Benjamin Bubu agrees that moving the capital to Wau would boost development in the area. Bubu says South Sudan can learn from other countries that have relocated their capital from one state to another. Nigeria moved its capital from Lagos to Abuja in 1991, and Tanzania moved its administrative capital from Dar es Salaam to Dodoma in 1974.
I have seen in many countries that the capital can start out in one place and then relocate to another so that the new area can develop. The idea is not new. So I hope our people will support the idea. Wau is a peaceful town and it holds many tribes.
But 30-year-old Paul Sabino Wadito says he fears moving the capital will harm poor residents of Western Bahar al-Ghazal because powerful people might try to take their land from them.
The question we raise, what make the state to move away from Juba? Because I think there have been some of the problem that was happening between the government and the indigenous people. They are lacking the respect to them. There was the lack of the respect. There was the confiscation of the land by the government and by the people who are, and the tribalism also included in this kind of thing.
In Juba, South Sudan's Information Minister Michael Mukwege had this to say about the proposal to move the capital to Wau.
The people of South Sudan have the right to express their opinion the way they want. But as to whether this capital will be transferred now or not, it's not a question of one state demanding it, but it needs more than that. So the government is not in a position at present to respond or to react to whatever is being said.
This is not the first time there has been talk of moving South Sudan's capital from Juba. In 2011, the cabinet approved a $10 billion plan to relocate the capital to Ramshel in Lake State. Officials say they needed to move the new area because they could not find enough land for government buildings in Juba. That plan was never implemented, largely because funding was not available. For VOA News, I am Michael Atiit in Wau.
There is a definite move in store for thousands of students from Upper Nile State University in Malakal. Officials say they are temporarily relocating the university to Juba. That will allow students to return to classes after 7 months of disruptions due to the ongoing fighting. For VOA, Anthony Moga has more from Juba.
When fighting erupted in Malakal on December 23rd, thousands of students were sitting for their examinations. Some were hoping to graduate a few weeks. But fighting between the pro and the anti-government forces got in the way of that. The town has since changed hands several times. Last week, the university administrations announced it would relocate the university to Juba for 1 year. Students officials say during the fighting, some of their facilities were destroyed and important students' records were lost, including academic results. Consequently, they say students will have to retake their examinations starting next week in Juba. Anthony Wani is the university's academic registrar.
And we know that most of our students are still in some areas in Upper Nile State, like in Washuluk, like in Onomis compound. So there are a big number of students there. So we wrote a letter to Onomis to help the transportation of these students so that they catch up with the examination in Juba Center. Because, you know, because of instability in Malakal town, it will be very difficult for Upper Nile University to send examination to Malakal at current moment.
Fourth-year education student Aki Akile welcomes the decision to relocate the university to Juba. He says because of fightings in Malakal, both past and present, he will complete his coursework in 7 years rather than four. But he's not letting that dampen his enthusiasm.
Because we are going to have so many challenges regarding us, where we are going to have our lecture halls, our accommodation for our students, and even for our staff. But we hope the government will help Upper Nile University in funding so that we can rent lecture halls, we can rent accommodation for students within Juba Town.
Kumi Allison, another education student at Upper Nile University, is also excited about the new arrangement, but says retaking the examinations will prove difficult since many students were forced to leave their studies materials behind.
When the conflict erupted in, many students were desperate, even were thinking how to come to Juba home. And that one also made some of us, even when we were coming, we left our handouts. And then that one is one of the things that will be affecting. But before, every student was prepared because that's one what one had to be, and one has to be also ready for it.
Despite the challenges, Wani says out of a total more than 2,000 students, an estimated 1,300 students have registered to retake the examinations in Juba. He says he realized running the university in Juba won't be easy. Among other things, officials say the university is looking at a projected budget of some 100 million South Sudanese pounds. Wani said he's not sure how they are going to get that money.
Because we are going to have so many challenges regarding us, where we are going to have our lecture halls, our accommodation for our students, and even for our staff. But we hope the government will help Upper Nile University in funding so that we can rent lecture halls, we can rent accommodation for students within Juba Town.
The National Minister of Education, John Gak-Yak, approved the university's relocation weeks ago. The National Minister of Education is expected to fund the relocation. For VOA News, I am Anthony Moga in Juba.
We continue our coverage of the International AIDS Conference in Australia with a report on a new series in the medical journal The Lancet. According to the series, achieving an AIDS-free generation will not be possible unless the human rights of sex workers are recognized. Researchers say sex workers face violence and discrimination and are not able to access the care, treatment, and prevention measures they need. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The Lancet article say people who sell sex, whether in high or low-income countries, face a disproportionate risk and burden of HIV. These include women, men, and transgenders. Much of the problem, the authors say, has to do with repressive and discriminatory law, policy, and practice. The series was presented at the 20th International AIDS Conference in Melbourne, Australia. Linda Gale Becker is one of the authors. She is a professor of medicine and deputy director of the Desmond Tutu HIV Center at the University of Cape Town.
Is something that all of us need to do as human beings. We're designed this way. This is what we're about. And if this is the way HIV is transmitted, then we need to just kind of face that and address that in such a way that people can continue to live their lives in ways that are sustainable, but we can protect them at the same time.
She says those in the profession prefer the term sex worker rather than prostitute.
The community is wanting to think of themselves as doing regular work. And I think that's in an effort to be recognized as individuals who have dignity and are making a living and work towards decriminalization of the profession.
Professor Becker says sex workers are a marginalized community.
There is huge stigma and discrimination that goes with that. And as a result, people find themselves on the fringe of communities, on the fringe of humanity.
Their activities are driven underground. She says they often do not have access to condoms, lubricants, HIV testing, and treatment for sexually transmitted diseases.
As a result, they become incredibly at risk for HIV acquisition. This virus is a non-discriminator of human beings, and it preys upon vulnerable individuals.
Much of the violence sex workers face comes from police, the very people, Becker says, who are supposed to protect. She says sex workers often face stigma and discrimination when they go to health clinics.
What I say as a public health individual is that I'm not here to decide on what people should or shouldn't be doing. What I need to do is use the tools at my disposal to make sure that individuals are protected from viruses, particularly when I've got the tools to enable that.
Those tools now include PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, whereby antiretroviral drugs are taken to prevent initial HIV infection. Also, new microbicides or vaginal gels are being developed that contain HIV-blocking drugs. Becker says the old ABC approach is no longer good enough.
I don't know what planet we were on when we thought this was going to be as simple as telling people to abstain, you know, hello, be faithful, or simply condomize. Now, condoms are great, but it's clear that that's a hard thing for people to do year in and year out.
She says a successful HIV prevention and treatment program must include community mobilization, that is, input from sex workers. Such programs have been effective in Thailand and India. Professor Becker says they should include peer education and voluntary counseling and testing. The Lancet series calls prevention programs for sex workers an urgent international priority, backed up by appropriate levels of funding from international and national health programs. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
That's our show for this Thursday. We leave you with the song Kulu Yan Dusman by Emmanuel Kembe. We've been listening to Emmanuel Kembe with the song Kulu Yan Dusman, I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for listening. We hope you tune in again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Rajil began.